Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast. Hey, welcome back to the show. It is stage number two of Mark Thomas on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin. Thank you so much for checking in. And this time out, Marco picks up right where we left off, and that's his race announcing. So we're up. I'm not even going to try it, but we are in stage number two. And, you know, when Marco and I were preparing for this interview, one of the things we talked about is, well, he's well known for race announcing, but has never actually asked for a job. It just kind of happened. And considering all the places he has worked, I thought that was a weird stat. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and I can't remember ever filling out an application, because, I mean, what is that like? I guess it is more common than not. I just hadn't thought of it that way. It's probably, like most things, you don't think about it until Marco says it the way that he says it, and then you're like, what? Then you think, and you're like, oh yeah, that's right. I've thought about that before myself, but just in a completely different way. So this time out, yes, he starts working at Star Speedway, but he doesn't, doesn't exactly apply for the job. Then we get into some cool 90s stuff, too. Geez, you know, the 90s were such an interesting time in short track racing here in the Northeast, where ACT, the original ACT, was thriving and then dissolved. And, you know, it's something we've talked about throughout a number of the guests we've had on the podcast, but each one of them have a different perspective on the same thing that went down. And Marco talks about the final days of ACT. We get into NESPA a little bit, or NESPA. I never knew how to pronounce that correctly. I still don't. But the Ralph Nason tour, basically, which he didn't necessarily have a part of. But one thing he did in that era was the racing paper. So how did the racing paper come about? I mean, it was a staple for such a long time in northern New England. And the way Marco kind of set up the racing paper is pretty spectacular, too. As far as profit margins and just the inner workings of a newspaper that runs on a weekly basis, that was pretty fascinating stuff. The Pro Truck Tour. We've covered the Pro Truck Tour on this podcast, and he gets into that a little bit, too. And one thing I hadn't thought about, again, coming back to how Marco presents the facts, is I hadn't thought of how groundbreaking the Pro Truck Tour was in the lens of today's racing, which is something he gets into. Also, epic partying in Cornish. But why Cornish? Multiple reasons. And actually, an OTP alum may or may not have been part of those parties. It's chock full of Marco info and lots of truth bombs. So thank you for the support. A lot of great feedback in stage number one. There will be a stage number three. Matter of fact, these next two are going to go pretty quickly. A few weeks ago, I mentioned that season three, which has been going so, so well, might not ever end. You know, it's one of those things where we got a lot of momentum this year, some really great stories, amazing guests, and more planned for the future. But, you know, life happens, and I'm definitely going to take a couple of weeks off after stage three of Marco. Mainly because of the move. Now, when you move as a 45, 50-year-old person, it's different when you move at this age than, say, when you were 25. Remember when you were 25 and, like, you could just move every year and it wasn't a problem? Like, you could just turn things around in a couple of days. And, I mean, I moved every year, I think, from when I was 22 to, I don't know, somewhere in my early 30s. But I hadn't moved in a while and obviously accumulated some stuff. And I mean, that's not the only reason. I just kind of needed to recharge the batteries. It certainly won't be the length of time that we had between seasons two and three. Matter of fact, I already have part of season four already planned out, some people lined up. So hoping for a return. If we, you know, what's funny is I thought that season three was probably going to start in September, and then I got really excited about some of the interviews we did. I'm like, I have to put these out now. Yeah, it's the present that you want to give somebody the day that you buy it, even though it's for Christmas, right? So even though I say we'll be on break for a couple of weeks after stage three of Marco next week or next time out. It might even be a week. I don't know. It just depends. I have a lot of interviews lined up for the week of December 11th, right? So who knows? All I'm saying is it's not going to be nearly as long as the last time. And that really has a lot to do with the support that you've been able to offer this podcast this season, specifically, whether it's through Patreon, which patreon.com/opentrailerpodcast, $5 a month gets you the early drop, also some merch and VIP status for an upcoming live show, which we'll talk about in a second. But it really just, helps keep the machine moving. Pay for some of the behind the scenes costs that go on with putting this together. I mean, this is certainly not a podcast that has a lot of overhead, but there are, there's some, and we like to make sure that we're on the good side of things. So that support's greatly appreciated. If you can't afford Patreon or that's not your thing, you don't know how to you can't figure it out. We've had some people who've checked in on that one. That's cool. I mean, you don't have to throw money to support the podcast. Just getting the word out through a share, through screenshotting the fact that you're listening to it, or, with your phone, taking a picture of the old radio dial. It's not really a radio dial anymore, but you know what I mean, the dashboard thing that you have there in your vehicle. Just take a picture of that, put it on your social story. That really, really helps get the word out and expose people to the podcast who may have never heard it before. So that's what this is all about. So many different ways that you can support, and each are greatly, greatly appreciated. Teaming up with Black Flag Podcast for our first live event. It's the off-season invocation. It's happening at Eric's Church, Good Times and Bad Dancing. That's happening on February 8th. It's a Thursday night. So it's a great way for the racing community in the Northeast to get together and hang out. We do this from time to time, but I mean, it's an opportunity for us to, put a label on what we do anyway, but give us a reason to go out and get home at a decent hour too. This is going on from 6:30 to 8:30. Guys in Black Flag will be doing their show. I'll be doing some open trailer trivia. This will all lead up to Jake Foss, who's awesome. He does killer karaoke. Well, it's not called killer karaoke, but it's karaoke and it's killer. And it happens after 8:30 or so. So that's going to be a lot of fun. There'll be some other cool things involved, too. And if you'd like to sponsor this, drop me a message, whether that's through email or DM. Let me know if your business would like to be a part of the first off-season invocation. We're taking sponsorships now, and people are lining up for it. I think it's going to be, I don't want to say I know because you never know tomorrow, but I would be certain it won't be the only time that we do this. We've received some amazing feedback and some great traction from this. So again, February 8th, that is Thursday night, Eric's Church, 6:30 to 8:30. It's a free event, 18 plus. It's the off-season invocation, a great way for our racing people to get together and racing podcasts to come together and promote each other, because that's what we're supposed to do. Even we're not competitors. I mean, you're competitors with everybody, but I want them to succeed and vice versa. That's what drives the product. It would be nice if everyone who was supposedly in competition would do that. I think their product would be stronger, but that's a different topic for a different day. At any rate, what we're doing is what we're doing, and I'm really proud of the message that we're sending out there. It is February 8th again, 6:30 to 8:30, Eric's Church. Speaking of sponsorships, if you'd like to sponsor one of these episodes, we actually haven't had a sponsorship. I've been running a white car basically for three seasons. Obviously, the individual support from Patreon is amazing too. But if your business wants to sponsor Open Trailer, just because you haven't seen it doesn't mean it isn't available. Let's talk. Let's sponsor. Get some sponsors on this program. And as I mentioned, Season 3 is pretty much taken care of, but if you want to line something up for Season 4, which will be at the latest January 2024, then let me know. Again, direct message. Don't send me an email, even though it's on Facebook, opentrailerpodcast@outlook.com. I don't even have the password to get into that. So if you sent me something there, sorry. It's kind of like the Apple thing. I don't have Apple products, but I needed an Apple email to put it on Apple Podcasts. And now that I have one, I never use it. So point being, just direct message, whether it's through Instagram or Facebook, I'll get at you there. So again, back to Marco. That's the whole reason why you're tuned in here. It is stage number 2 of Mark Thomas on Open Trailer Podcast. Let's go.
That's cool. But yeah, you end up at Star Speedway, and how do you end up on the mic there?
Well, Spence had stopped working. John Spence, Hall of Fame, a good guy. And he wasn't there. I can't remember, but he was still working at Hudson. And somebody else was hired, and I can't really remember who. And I used to tell Bob, you know, Weber, just joking. I said, I could do a better job than this guy. I could do a better job than this guy. And then one day, that guy didn't show up there. He called out sick at the last minute. And he says, well, he says, I'm going to give you a chance now. He said, you could do a better job than this guy in here. And so they hand me the microphone, tell me to, you know, go announce the races. Never done it before. Did no preparation. Well, I mean, I had done it that one.
Right.
15 years sooner.
What year is this now? This is probably 87?
I can't remember exactly, but yeah, it's, you know, it's after 85 for sure. And, you know, at the end of the night, he say, you know, you're going to do this every week.
Oh, wow. I fired the other guy.
Yeah, that was it. He was done.
Wow.
I still feel bad.
That's all right. You know, so you're doing the print media stuff, and, you know, this is a pretty crucial time in you know, asphalt stock car racing in the Northeast. What do you remember about the NASCAR North days and, you know, and following that, especially in Vermont? With the John Paul Cabanas, the Robbie Crouches, the Jamie Obies. How much of a part of that were you?
You know, I mean, I look back on a bunch of this stuff and, you know, like, I wish I had the same outlook on racing then that I have now, because at that time, all I wanted to see was steel-bodied stock cars. I mean, so I was like, definitely prejudiced against what the ACT was doing. I wanted things to stay steel.
Were you at Catamount at that infamous 85 race where the lawsuit, you know, transpired? Or the race that brought on the lawsuit?
No, I wasn't there.
Okay.
I mean, I was at the speedway scene, but
I wasn't
at that race.
What was the climate for you as a writer at that point, because that was a very controversial thing, that NASCAR North ACT split. Where were you? Where did you stand on that?
You know, it was the Crouch versus LaJoy factions, and for some reason they both hated me. They both thought that I was favoring the other side.
Really?
In the newspapers.
And the thing is they would read religiously what you wrote every single week. You know, I mean, back in the day, you know, a couple of things were huge. You know, radio was huge, obviously, because they covered all the races. And print media. I mean, there was the power of the pen, and you had the eyes of the Northeast on your article every single week. Not just the track write-ups, but obviously Marco's turn. What would they say to you? How do you know that they didn't like you?
Well, you know, it would be like,
especially with C.A. Crouch endorsing you.
I can remember Randy LaJoy calling me a Crouch lover more than once.
Yeah.
See, it was hard for me because, first, I had family members that were on the Crouch crew.
Oh, wow. Is that how you knew C.A.?
No. That was...
Oh, that's a different team. Yeah, I'm sorry.
But,
yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, and the C.A. stuff was way before this anyway. I mean, but... yeah, I don't know. I even lost my whole train of thought on this.
So basically, Randy LaJoy was calling you a Crouch lover.
Yeah, I can. I mean,
but you had family on the Crouch team.
Well, the Crouch people really didn't even know that it was family. But
right,
you know, but because I was perceived as being pro LaJoy in the ACT office and amongst the. You know, mostly because I was more positive to NASCAR, I'm sure of it, back then, even though I haven't looked back to study what I did back then, but I'm quite sure that I was, you know, like more positive, you know, and more supportive of the NASCAR stuff, and especially so once they decided to build that track in Loudon.
Yeah, I mean, the million-dollar tour of, I think it was like 84, 85. So there's a lot of money involved with this, you know, NASCAR touring division. And the big rift between Crouch and LaJoy and everything goes on for years. you know, Tom Curley starts this whole thing, American Canadian Tour, which, you know, was fine for you for the first year because they had steel-bodied race cars. But then they go off and do with, you know, fiberglass bodies. How did that hit you?
I mean, I just didn't like the fact that, you know, like it took our world and divided it because, I mean, hey, you had all the best full-bodied guys in one place. And that wasn't the case anymore.
Do you think they could have ever resolved that? Cooler heads? You know, 40 years in the rearview mirror now?
Well, yeah, but, you know, I mean, everybody made their own mistakes. Now, what would have happened, though, if they had done it differently? I mean, we'll never know.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Curly was wearing a lot of hats at that time, okay?
Did you get along with him?
You know, like, I think I did.
Yeah. Well, that's important. Right.
You know, I mean, we had, you know, I mean, we did have a few discussions here or there, and, you know, and I was, you know, told how stupid I was several occasions, and sometimes he was right.
Would he call you on the telephone after reading your article, or would he just see you in the pits and say something?
I mean, occasionally I even got where they'd photocopy my column, and I would get handwritten scrawls critiquing my work mailed back to me from the big guy, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were in his head rent-free?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Had a good time.
That's awesome. So when does the so tell me a good Tom Curley story. Do you have a, you know, from when you guys got along, you know, anything from that era that really sticks out?
The thing that stands out the most to me out of all the conversations that I had with Mr. Curley was how hard he laughed when I said cubby bear when we were talking about something that was going on at Loudon, and he had never heard that right. Nickname before, and
which goes to who?
Gary Bear, Cubby.
Yeah, Cubby.
Bob's boy.
Yeah.
So, anyway, it was a lot of us used that name back then, and I was just, you know, I was kind of shocked that
he had not heard it.
Yeah, Curly hadn't heard it. That took him about 5 minutes to stop laughing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, when does the racing paper come around?
Oh man. Yeah, we started that in 1992.
Is it that late? I thought it was earlier than that. So
no.
why did you start the racing paper to begin with?
You know, like from say 1975 until 1991 or so, I could write whatever the frig I wanted to in the speedway scene, and nobody gave me any trouble whatsoever. There was no cutting stuff out of my columns. There was no anything, right?
Right.
And then someone who I hired to be my helper when I was laying the speedway scene out there when Bones left, he had you know, another employer as well on the weekends up there in Unity, who a lot of people know that I also had a nice feud with in various publications from time to time. And
who was that?
Ralph.
Okay. The guy.
I'm wearing a shirt on.
I was
right
going
to
say, you're wearing a shirt, so apparently that's all buried.
Oh, I've always been a big fan of Ralph the Driver, though.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Stuff was getting cut out of my column at the speedway scene, and I did. I wrote one column that I knew that they would never print, and
well, but why did you write it?
Because we were going to start this newspaper, and I just wanted to say, "Here's your last chance."
That was the catalyst. That was the excuse.
Yeah, yeah, if you don't print this column word for word, I'm going to quit and start my own paper.
Wow,
and.
What did Val say to this?
Yeah, we'll see. And then, you know.
Yeah.
So the column didn't get printed. And the next week there was a racing paper.
Wow. Within 1 week, You able to turn that around?
You know, like putting a newspaper out isn't all that hard.
Really? To me, it seems like a major undertaking.
Yeah, especially now. I mean, it was even a little harder back then. In the
90s. Imagine. That's what I'm saying.
All right. Because, I mean, like right now, all you got to do is you can take almost any program on Earth that, you know, that you can type in, say, like Microsoft Publisher.
Right.
All right. And lay the newspaper out right there on those little pages there. And then convert it to a PDF and email it to the printer, and they can run it right off on the press. It's
but back then, you were telling us about storyboards and shooting things at 70%, making sure all the photos fit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
50 years ago.
That's a talent, though. I mean, that's, to me, it blows my mind to think that, you know, how prepared were you to start the racing paper in advance of giving this article to Speedway Scene? Did you kind of have it in your back pocket that you were ready to go? You were just waiting for them to say no?
I didn't really even want to start this paper at first. But, I got to the point where, I could not have this individual be allowed to cut my column.
Well, you were being censored.
Yes.
It was straight censorship.
Yes.
And Tom Zemane wouldn't want to bat.
Tom Zemane.
Yeah. So you start the racing paper. Let's just say, okay, I mean, I'm still amazed that you were able to turn that around within the first week, okay? But you don't do it alone. Who's along with you on the ride?
Oh, Dave Smith. We had a good time.
How'd you guys meet, you and Dave?
How did we meet? Pretty sure we met at Donnie Letarte's, one of those legendary Wednesday night parties.
Tell me about those.
Well, Donnie Letarte's race car shop was on Route 25 in Cornish, which, now I'm not sure because I haven't lived in the neighborhood for quite a while, but back in the day, Cornish was well known as the biggest town in Maine without a police department. And we were about a mile down the road from Mason's, which was an agency liquor store. And, you know, the tool guys and, you know, all the other jobbers and stuff would stop by, and a bunch of customers. And, you know, they'd usually be 12, 15, 18 people all hanging around, having a good old time on Wednesdays.
Who is there, just to kind of name drop a little bit?
I don't know. I know you had Corey on your...
I did, yeah.
I remember seeing Corey there once or twice. I mean, maybe not every day.
Was he getting
day,
his car repaired because he crashed
he
a lot?
He may have, but, you know, when he was younger, he liked to have fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Most definitely.
And
so Corey Sanborn's the biggest name out of that?
I don't know. No, we had all kinds of people there, but, you know, I can't really, you know, my memory's shot. I mean, this is 35.
I don't think it is. I really don't think it is. I get
you. It's 35 years ago.
Yeah, I think you're holding back a little bit, but that's okay. That's all right.
We had some fun.
Yeah.
And like I said, the agency liquor store down the street, you know, there may have been other substances involved.
Yes. So that's a definite yes. So,
because Willie worked there back then too.
Willie Elliott?
Yes.
Okay. So there's a name.
Yeah, we had some fun there.
Yeah. So you guys, you and Dave Smith, so you guys are just like, hey, guy, you know what we need to do? Start a newspaper. And you do. Like, how does he help you out? How does he get you to publication?
Well, I'm like the world's worst salesman. You know, so we need ads. So, so I, you know, kind of concentrate on the production aspects, and he concentrates on, trying to bring some cash in.
Yeah. So we talk a lot about the racing stuff. I mean, you're real busy with the racing paper. You had been in Speedway Scene. We talked a little bit about working at Tom's of Maine. But, like, what were you primarily doing for a paycheck during this time? Like, when the off... Because racing season is only about 3 or 4 months out of the year, even though Speedway Scene's a year-round publication. What kind of job are you doing? Or jobs are you doing?
Well, I mean, I had that job at Tom's of Maine for a little while because, you know, mostly because I needed a job that... you know, where I could go to the bank and get a loan.
Yeah, steady job.
You know, yeah, Val's references weren't all that credible at the bank.
No, I get it, yeah. So how long does Speedway Scene go? How long are Speedway Scene and the racing paper dueling race papers in Maine?
They stopped publishing Speedway Scene in 2006.
Okay.
And it extended the racing paper's life for about 5 years because, I mean, we were probably about a month away from going belly up when the Speedway Scene went belly up. And then, you know, I did pick up a healthy shot of advertisers when he went away.
Well, yeah, they were ticked off because I think he just cut the... Didn't he just stop the paper? Like, he didn't say it was going out of business?
Yeah.
Yeah. He kind of just took the money?
I don't know about taking the money. I mean, it's not, you know, because, I mean, there are... I mean, I did the same thing.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like... I think he had a lot more subscribers than I did.
Yeah. At the most, how many subscribers did the racing paper have?
Oh, only like 700, but you got to remember we were giving the thing away for free everywhere.
Right. Yeah, you know? Richard Benway was giving that thing away everywhere. I'd see him.
Yeah. Richard.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Richard for a while.
I saw him over at Bartlett Bridge Raceway, the go-kart track.
I thought of him on the way here because I drove by, you know, where he used to live with his... parents there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't even pick it out, but I hadn't been on that road for years. But
wow,
Richard was fabulous.
Yeah, he's a great dude. So you have like 700 subscribers on the racing paper. You know, tell me, how big's the staff for the racing paper at this point?
Oh, there's no staff.
No?
No, I'm the entire operation as far. There was never any payroll at Racing Paper, ever. Right? We got to, you know.
Was that your full-time job
That was, you know, yeah. Once Dave got out, yeah, that was all I did.
Really? So how did you guys part? Why did that?
Well, he went to work for Michael Liberty.
Oh. What would he do for Liberty?
Is he
a salesman?
Nah, he was mostly an advisor and a consultant at the racetrack because that was when the Liberty Curly thing happened. I don't even remember exactly, you know, how do you call it? Did Curly leave? Did Liberty throw him out? But, you know, the one thing that we do know is that, you know, Michael didn't pay Curly what he owed him. And that was the end of the original ACT touring series.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Backing up a little bit, Mike Liberty comes onto the scene at Oxford in the, you know, the mid to late 80s. What was your first impression of him? Because he just kind of came out of nowhere.
Well, you know, like the first impression was, you know, like, wow, this guy's, you know, because he's building those skyboxes and everything else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, and I really liked the fact that he was throwing money at the races there at first, too. You know, those $5,000 street stock races. And
yeah.
I mean, it was, I thought it was fabulous at first, you know, And the thing that I like best about Michael Liberty is he was a part owner of the Maine Mariners, and anytime I wanted hockey tickets, he'd give them to me.
That's how he got you. That's awesome.
Yeah, but...
I'm surprised Liberty didn't build a house for you. He was real estate guy, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, my best Liberty story is, you know, like the one day... I mean, he's paying me like... $75 or something to, you know, like make copies and hand them out to people, you know, be his press box steward at some big race or something like that. And then he wants some flyers put on windshields of cars. And my kid was there that night. So he, you know, gets my kid to go out and put flyers on the windshields of cars. And he pays my kid $300. He gives me $75. He gives my kid
$300. Wow. You sure he didn't get that one backwards? He just messed up?
No. He was just trying to, you know.
Yeah, those days at Oxford were pretty neat. I mean, you know, that's right around the time, even before that, the NASCAR North guys are coming up for the tour, the NASCAR South guys are coming up for the 250. And, you know, my perspective as a fan was like they came up here and they, you know, did well and they really enjoyed being here and it was great and it looks great on photos, but they didn't really like being around here. Can you expand on that a little bit?
What, you mean like Tommy Ellis?
Yeah.
I mean, among anybody else, I mean, I mean, you really can't blame these guys, right? NASCAR tells you, hey, we're going to have this touring series. The rules are going to be the same for everybody, everywhere we go, this, that, and the other thing. You know, we're going to have races on big tracks, little tracks, 30 races, you know, and then you go up to Oxford. You got to race against cars that are a foot wider, 3 inches lower than yours, you know.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases, with bigger carburetors and more horsepower, and, you know, you really can understand why they were all pissed off about this. But, you know.
Back, so why do they do it? For points?
Well, yeah, you needed to keep yourself in contention for the championship. And it wasn't just points, because they all had all these plans back then. You remember the plans, right?
Yeah, contingency.
So, like, if you were in the top 20 in points, you get, like, $1,000 just for being that. You know, they had it built in the purse to keep you keep coming back. So if you weren't there every week, you didn't get as much money as the regulars.
Do you think today's touring suffers as a result of the lack of contingencies that they have or had for those guys back then?
No.
Why do you think touring isn't nearly as big as it was 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Well, it's, I mean, everything's kind of in decline, I think.
Hmm.
I mean, you've got less racetracks, and everybody, I mean, the promoters aren't promoters anymore. I mean, these people used to try to put people in the grandstand and entertain them. And now all they're doing is trying to sell more tires. And, you know, I mean, now you got guys, I'm getting their fingers in the crate engine business here. Let's, you know, take a little bit more money off these guys there and save them a few bucks. And, you know, like, yeah, we'll put a grand in our pocket, too.
Yeah.
You know, now, I mean, when I was a kid, the promoters, Thunder Road and Catamount, tried to save the people money by putting in a $65 tire rule. And, you know, instantly there, you know, the tire dealers started, you know, charging for mounting and balancing and stuff like that that they hadn't done before, and, you know, turned into a little bit of fiasco. But, you know, now what are they doing? They get the market cornered. They're selling the tires and, yeah, you know, making all the money. And, I mean, that's just never the way it was. So, I mean,
too much self-interest, I guess, is what you're saying.
Well, you know, I mean, they're not, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm saying, you know, they're not promoters.
Right. No,
not,
I get it.
They're
yeah.
track operators now.
It's a big difference.
Yeah.
That's a keen insight on that. Yeah, not to abandon the Tommy Ellis story, though. I guess he was pissed. You had a pretty good antidote on that, or pretty good take on that.
Well, I mean, I can remember being up in the press box with him after the race there, and, I mean, he did. He was talking about running against all these junk race cars, and, you know, like, I mean, you'd almost have to admit, if you weren't up there anyway, that those NASCAR cars were awful pretty compared to some of those Saturday night cars.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it really, you know, it's really amazing that these guys did manage to pull off, you know, the wins in these races here, too, because, I mean, if it was today and they were at that much of a disadvantage at the rules, they would be no way that they could win these races, I don't think.
Yeah.
You know?
So, you know, just jumping back to, you know, the ACT demise in 95, or at least, you know, the pro stock part of things. NEPSA comes around, you know, with Ralph Nason and everything. And this is, you know, right, you know, your racing papers right in the middle of that tour. What were some memories of NEPSA?
Oh, poor Mike Lang, the late Mike Lang. He was Ralph's PR guy. Always caught between us because, you know, and he wanted, you know, to take care of us, but, you know, take care of Ralph, and it was impossible to do both, you know, and like, I always had an issue. The issue I had with Ralph was I didn't think that the guy that was, you know, like running the tour should be racing on the tour.
Right. Were you the race announcer for that?
No, I never. No.
Okay.
But... Yeah. The one thing about I did work for Ralph one day, you know, before it was all over. I did work for Ralph one day.
That Unity?
Huh? That Unity, yeah. Okay. Nobody could believe that one, but yep, I did work for Ralph one day.
Why could nobody believe that? Was it a known rift?
Well, I mean, he had lots of bad things to say about me for quite a while.
Yeah. As a result of your column?
Well, you know, part of it, you know, with the column there, and, you know, some of it was probably being too close to Liberty during the feud there, because I don't know if you remember, there was one year there where Ralph and Dave St. Clair kind of conspired to run a 250 on the same day as the Oxford 250.
I don't remember that.
Oh, it was Cassett, yes.
Not the big dog.
No, they did. They actually ran a big race on the same day as the Oxford 250 one year in the 90s, during the NEPSA years. I can't remember exactly which year.
Yeah, ask
Hogg.
Hogg
will tell you.
Yeah.
Hogg took it in the shorts that day. Ralph didn't lose anything.
I did not know that. Oh, wow. Because, yeah, Dave was running, was Cassett, and Ralph was doing NEPSA. Yeah, so that didn't, why don't you think that lasted very long?
How can you race against, I mean, first, Ralph's a really good racer. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no arguing that. He always was. I mean, but how, you know, when he's in charge of everything, you know, how can you beat him?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just.
It's like even, Boss Hogg, but like the real, like the, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard version of Boss Hogg.
Yeah. I was going to say, because if you're talking about Wisconsin, Boss Hogg, I can, you know, like. They probably had a better handle on family racing at their own racetrack than anyone I've ever seen.
The St. Clairs.
The St. Clairs, yes. Yeah. I mean, you never really, I mean, anywhere else that you'd go, if there was, you know, the promoter's kid was racing or something, you'd be hearing about it. And I mean, you wouldn't hear all that much about the St. Clairs, and there was usually a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even if, you know.
Still is.
Yeah, but I'm, you know.
Yeah.
But it never seemed to be an issue there compared to, I mean, I'm not saying it never was an issue, but I mean,
it
was much less of a factor, I think, than almost anywhere else where someone's kid was racing.
Do you remember the Pro Truck Tour, Phil Rose?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Well, tell me about that.
I don't really have a whole lot to offer about the Pro Truck Tour except for, you know, like, I mean, he did show Tom Curley that the crate motor thing would work. I'll give him credit for that.
He was doing it years before Curley brought it to the fold.
Yeah, and, you know, you got to give him credit for that. But I don't know. I mean, I never was a fan of Phil Rowe.
Yeah.
And I can remember not hearing good things about him when he left Beechridge.
Yeah. I mean, I was. He hired me at Lee for that 1 year, and I maybe spoke to him twice, and then he fired me via voicemail on my mom's answering machine. That was the last I heard of Phil Rowe. No, wait a minute. I lie. No, I just I misremembered. No, he wanted me to announce his Pro Truck Tour, and I'm like, I was like, no, not nice try. Oh man. So yeah, no, it's too bad. It was a nice little tour.
But hey, why you know? I mean, if you want to get fired from anywhere anyway, it might as well be Lee, because they always have those stupid rules and nobody can hear you on the PA at Lee anyway.
Yeah.
Because they got that decibel. Well, I don't know if they still did, but they did at one time, right? I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I worked there last year. It was great experience. I mean, I had fun. But yeah, so the first time I worked there, I was with Pete Falcone. And Mike Joy actually moved in for a couple of shows, and that was kind of fun. What's the worst thing that someone ever said to you about your column based on something that you wrote? Did you ever get any death threats?
I've had people throw rocks at me in the pits. I don't recall any death threats or anything like
that. What's the worst thing?
The worst, I mean, I really don't remember. You know, I mean, most of the time, I mean, the ones that make me laugh are the ones that, you know, that I remember most. It's like Dave St. Clair calling me up, telling me not to bother to send any papers up to Wisconsin so he won't have to bother to throw them in the dumpster and stuff like that.
Yeah.
He'd be mad about, and he'd be mad about like something insignificant in like Ron Michaud's column that nobody's going to read anyway, you know, like at least at his racetrack, because the guy always writes, you know, about Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he some throwaway comment about Whiskas that's sarcastic and, you know, and then, you know, like Hogs wigging out.
Yeah.
You know, pick your battles, guy.
Stage two, I think once Marco got heated up in stage one, it has been full throttle since, and we really bring it home in stage number three.
As I understand it, you had some health issues that you had to take care of. Can you care to elaborate on those?
Well, I mean, I did have some prostate cancer, and you know, did some treatment and stuff like that, and I think that's pretty much gone now. And
that's awesome, man.
And then the last year before I got canned at Oxford, I was legally blind.
Why are we laughing at this?
I don't know, but
you're,
I mean, I,
you're
no,
a race announcer, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, especially up there at Oxford where you can't see the backstretch on a good day.
Right.
I mean, you know, like at night, forget about it, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm up there and, you know, and I got cataracts.
That's next time out on Open Trailer Podcast. My name's Andy Austin. Thank you for your support.